So I'm following, I'm going to use the blackboard, so that forces me to go much slower, and I will therefore concentrate on one particular problem and try to explain that in some detail. And I've actually chosen the problem, this particular application. Mostly the application takes place just in the upper half plane. So I think for those who aren't complete experts in automorphic forms, this should still be reasonably understandable. The proof, however, uses L functions, and that will only come next lecture. So I'm going to talk about equidistribution. Of eigenfunctions, which was the third topic in my applications. I mentioned quite a few yesterday in the overhead thing. You can go very quickly, and I'm going to discuss the third topic of eigenfunctions. And this is still, in a way that's not at all clear, an application in part of L functions. But the problem that I'll be talking about initially is apparently got nothing to do with L functions. So let's take the upper half plane. And let gamma be something like SL2Z, like it was yesterday, or some subgroup like that, but any subgroup of SL2R, any lattice, and pretend it's compact. Even compact, and I want you to think of it as being compact when I formulate these problems, this problem. Compact quotient, that is. Co-compact. So if I look at the upper half plane and I take the quotient by gamma, which acts on the upper half plane by linear fractional transformations like yesterday, then you'll get a Riemann surface of some genus, looks something like this. It's a compact quotient. And because the hyperbolic plane has this line element, ds, which is dz over y, which makes it into a hyperbolic or constant negative curvature minus 1 hyperbolic metric, as it's called, I have a motion of geodesics on here, which is the first thing I want to discuss. So back here in this picture, if I take a point in a direction, unit direction, is a unique geodesic, which starts off in that at that point and unit direction, and I go with speed, unit speed, I land up with a new point in direction. And so I get what is called the geodesic flow on the points and directions, which is, I'll denote the co-directions, S star, the unit circle bundle to X, the set of points and co-directions, meaning the dual of vectors, co-vectors. And we have a geodesic flow, GT, which maps S star X into S star X, as I just described it. And yet T is between minus infinity to infinity. T negative means flow in the opposite direction. This is called the geodesic flow. It's a Hamilton flow. And we can talk about Hamilton mechanics, Hamilton flow. And I want to talk about something, the classical, so this is what I'll call the classical flow. I want to talk about the classical variance or fluctuations, classical fluctuations. Automorphic forms will show their head when I quantize this story, but even here there's something that will be related to automorphic forms in a way, as I described yesterday. So Oh, by the way, I can describe this in another way, which is very convenient. Before I do that, just 1 second here. We can identify the points and directions. The set of points is the upper half plane divided by gamma. The upper half plane is SL2R over SO2. I had that yesterday. The stabilizer. And this is just a circle, and so it's not surprising and easy to show that the cotangent space, or the tangent space, can be identified with SL2R over gamma. So this is now a three-dimensional space. The set of points and directions actually can be realized concretely as SL2R, where I divide by gamma, the same group, and the geodesic flow, GT, geodesic probably in this country, geodesic flow takes a very nice form here that the coset G gamma will go to g gamma times e to the t over 2, e to the minus t over 2. So I just multiply on the right by this one parameter diagonal subgroup, e to the t, e to the minus t. And if you actually use this e to the t over 2, e to the minus t over 2, this will be unit speed in the hyperbolic metric. So this is this geodesic flow in concrete terms as a flow on this homogeneous space SL to R over gamma. Or you might even start thinking more generally on G mod gamma. I should have said one of the points about this is that this flow, this Hamiltonian flow, is ergodic and even some fancy word, chaotic. I don't know what chaotic means other than various qualities that it be a nose off, that have positively up enough exponents as a classical flow. But ergodic, let me remind you what that means, because that's quite important. It's also mixing. It's got all the properties of chaotic dynamics. The ergodic part is the statement that almost every orbit, so if I start with a random point in the set of measure and direction, almost every orbit will become equidistributed in the unit tangent space as I flow on this geodesic. That's a well-known theorem of Hopf. And these are very well-known in this context in the space G mod gamma. So this is an ergodic Hamiltonian system. And one of the things I want to look at in connection with this ergodic Hamiltonian is fluctuations, classical fluctuations. So let A be a function on G mod gamma. G is going to be SL to R here. Most of this lecture, that's all looking at this very simple setup. A smooth function. All right, so it's a function of G if I realize S star X this way. I'm going straight to this realization. Then if I look at, I want to look at the fluctuations of A, of this function of G, on a typical orbit. The thing about classical mechanics of this Hamiltonian type here, there are a lot of periodic orbits. So, of course, if I restrict it here to a closed geodesic, the function, the behavior of A along that would be simply periodic. But what about the behavior of A along a typical equidistributed orbit? So one way to measure this is let's look at 1 over t, the integral from 0 to t of A of g. Gt, I write the action on the right, as I did over there. This will be called Gt. Well, I've called it Gt. Dt. So this is the time average with starting point G. So ergodicity, which said that these become equidistributed, says this converges to A bar, which is just the average value. Of course, this flow preserves the measure, dg, the half measure is preserved. Should have said that. So the time average, this is for almost all g, the time average converges to the space average. That's equivalent to ergodicity. But there's a much more interesting issue. Is suppose now we look at the fluctuations. This is just the average. For the fluctuations, there's a central limit theorem, and it's a very beautiful theorem. So let me tell you what the central limit theorem is here for this flow. And it captures, it's there because the system is highly chaotic and a nose-off. It's not true for any dynamical system in general. The central limit theorem, this is one of the early theorems of Ratner. At least she got the most general version of it. And it tells you the following. Let's look for fluctuations. So let A bar be zero, let's subtract the mean of A. And now, how does the integral from zero to t of A of g, g, t behave? So these are like partial sums in the ordinary central limit theorem, and this is just an integral. So as a function of t, so for almost all g starting points, and as a function of capital T, this thing here should be about square root in size, because I'm integrating up to t. Central limit theorems are typically you divide by square root of t. And this, the fact that I'm saying central limit theorem, the theorem, it's quite a remarkable theorem, not very difficult, but quite pleasing. becomes Gaussian as capital T goes to infinity. So this, the values assumed here is a very capital T. So these are, say, A is real valued. The values assumed that as a function of T, I ask how often this quantity will be between alpha and beta. It will be the area under the Gaussian with some very important variance that I want to specify here. So this becomes Gaussian or normal. So this is Ratner's central limit theorem about the geodesic flow on a negatively curved surface. Gaussian with mean, well, the mean is zero. I fixed it up. Mean zero. And variance, a very interesting quantity. V of A, which I want to write down for you. I need to compute it for this lecture. It's not really computed in the literature. It's given as follows. V of A, so this is the variance, is the integral from minus infinity to infinity, the integral over G mod gamma. This is for almost all G. A of G, GT, A of G, DG, DT. I'll have to explain why that converges. And that's some interesting quadratic form. So V of A is a quadratic form. On, well, I'm only going to think of smooth functions, but it can be easily extended to functions of mean zero. That's, I have to have mean zero. I'm now looking at fluctuations on our phase space, which is G mod gamma in this picture. So this is a, we get this classical quadratic form, classical variance. Let me make some comments. This function of t here, when t is zero, this will be just the integral of a squared. So a is real valued. So, and maybe I normalize a to have L to norm 1, then this function is 1. Then when I integrate over t, the most important remark to make is that as t gets large, these things which are called correlations decay exponentially, so that integral converges absolutely. That's all part of Ratner's work. These correlations decay exponentially. So this is well-defined, and it gives us on functions of mean zero. They go to zero rapidly because A has mean zero. And so this gives us a well-defined quadratic form on functions of mean zero, which I will call the classical variance, because it's what dictates the classical central limit theorem. So I'll call V of A the classical variance. And it's the variance that you get along a typical classical orbit of the function A. So all this is classical mechanics on this hyperbolic surface. I want to compute V of A because it could be important. Can we compute V of A? Well, let's polarize this form. This is a very important quadratic form for us, and it should be computable in this kind of example. So if I polarize, I claim, it's very easy to see, the following property, that V of AB, so I make it a bilinear form. If I look at V of AB, then I'll have the following identity. V of ADB is V of DAB. Where D is called the Casimir operator. So this is the center of the universal enveloping algebra of the Lie group of G, which just is little SL2. So it's some differential operator on the group which commutes with translations. It's a second order operator. It's the generator of the center. And what this quadratic form does is it says that this quadratic form is self-adjoint relative to that D. You can move D from that side to that side. Or what's another way of saying it is D commutes with this, and it is easy to check from the definition. If you write down what VAB is and just use the fact that that's Casimir and integrate by parts. So this elementary property shows, that to understand V, that V is diagonalized, this quadratic form is diagonalized. If you have a quadratic form, it's always good to diagonalize, it will tell you a lot. So it's diagonalized by, in this constant curvature case where I have this Casimir operator, these central limit theorems are even true much more generally, and I actually don't know how to write down the exact variance in general. I think it's not known. But here one can compute it, and so this is diagonalized by the irreducible So you see, I introduced yesterday, we actually took this view on automorphic forms, and this is very convenient here, by the irreducible representations of L to G mod gamma. In other words, if I take the guys which are orthogonal to the constant L naught and write this as a direct sum of irreducibles under the right regular representation, then this condition of commuting with the Casimir operator, which you can check, says that this quadratic form will be diagonalized on these irreducible subspaces, which I actually had secretly introduced yesterday. So that means to understand this quadratic form, I only have to know what happens, what VAB is for A and B in the same irreducible. Because they say in different irreducibles, they are orthogonal. So this reduces to calculating V pi, V, this V is not that V, V on a V pi, irreducible, and let me just do it in the simplest case. So suppose I'll use here a little bit of representation theory of SL2R only. So suppose V pi is spherical. So this is an irreducible representation of SL2R. And spherical means there exists a vector phi in V pi. It's essentially unique. I'll normalize it to L2 norm 1 such that phi is right k, right invariant by the maximal compact. So it's a function of g, and phi of gk equals phi of g in this irreducible subspace. Of course, it's in the space L2 g mod gamma. But as an abstract representation, this is what spherical means. If k is in SO2, the same compact subgroup that appears there. So I'll assume that it's spherical just to write this computation. Then, if you go back to this definition or this definition of this quadratic form V, you'll recognize that in that case and in all cases, that first, that inner product, the integral over G mod gamma, is really a matrix coefficient, and that becomes, from the theory of spherical functions, some explicit Legendre function, and then that integral is some weird integral of a Legendre function, which I did, and I got the following answer. And so this is the exact form of the variance in Ratner's theorem in this case. V of phi, so now phi is spherical. It's determined, by the way, by the property that if phi is now, phi itself is a function on G, because this was all on G mod gamma, but it's right K invariant, so it really lives on H, and this Casimir operator, when restricted to functions which are right invariant, becomes the ordinary hyperbolic Laplacian, which I introduced yesterday that we'll see over and over again. And so let me assume that Laplacian phi plus a quarter plus t phi squared times phi is zero. So I'm just saying the answer for the variance depends only on this Archimedean eigenvalue, on the spherical function parameter, Sataki parameter. And v phi then is, this is a strange expression, but will be the highlight of the lecture, so I better write it down exactly. V of phi is gamma 1/4 minus I T phi. This is a calculation of doing a certain integral of a Legendre function from 0 to infinity. I must confess I use a table of integrals. Means that 19th century guys have worked this out for you, and you know you can do it if you were really pressed, but if you're lazy, you just copy it and hope that they got it right. Well, you'll see from the final step, I'm sure it's right. So this is some ratio of gamma functions at special points. The special points determined by the parameter T phi, that is the spherical parameter. And you could compute this on any other V pi. So what I'm trying to tell you is that the classical variance, of the way a function varies on a classical generic orbit, according to Ratner's theorem, is that it varies like a Gaussian. So the values, so this is what we're doing physically. We have this dynamical system, this geodesic flow. I'm taking a generic point. I evaluate A along this, my function A. And as I evaluate A, this, I get a very random behavior, which is Gaussian. And the variance is given by this formula, which on irreducibles, if the actual function A is in an irreducible, can be computed in terms of old-fashioned representation theory. I looked, if anybody had ever computed this before, it would be the Gelfand school, but because they talked about ergodicity in terms of representation theory, but I didn't see it. Anyway, this will be part of a global, local to global formula. This will be the Archimedean part of some answer of something interesting, so I had to bring it to the fore. So that is the classical variance. And now let me turn to quantum mechanics, quantum fluctuations, which is the equidistribution problem I'm interested in. So we see our eigenfunctions entered here anyway. We were just doing classical mechanics of this geodesic motion. The eigenfunctions entered in computing the variance of the motion, but the quantum is actually all about the eigenfunction. So if you have this classical Hamiltonian, classical geodesic flow on this classically ergodic and chaotic system, whenever you have Hamiltonian, you can quantize it. And I want to review quantize this. It's not a unique process. Quantization is a quite tricky mathematical step. In fact, as I say, it's not unique, so it can be quite confusing. But for a system like this, it can be canonically quantized. And let me tell you what we are talking about when we quantize this. So when you quantize, you're supposed to replace classical observables by quantum observables and the flow, the classical mechanics, by the Schrodinger equation. And what that amounts to, firstly, is so A, let A be in C infinity of S star X. Of the, this is my function I started off with. That's a classical observable. It's a function on phase space that if you have a classical trajectory, this is what you measure. You want to quantize it, so I won't go through the full quantization procedure, but you want to define op A, an operator, self-adjoint operator, actually, if A is real, an operator on L2 of your manifold. So the functions on the G mod gamma in the C, I'm just sticking to this example, but this is true in general. Classical mechanics takes place on the phase space, which is the unit cotangent bundle here. The quantization will give operators on the space X again. So you want an operator made out of A, which is an operator on this. And the way you do this is you choose, so I'm going to just do this with an example, a pseudo-differential operator of order zero. So you see the pseudo-differential operator as a principal symbol, which is a function on the phase space of some degree. It's homogeneous of some degree. So if A is here a function which is a function on the unit cotangent space, I extend it to be homogeneous of degree zero. That gives me a degree zero function in the xi variable. So x, my variable here is xi. X is a point on the manifold. Xi is a unit direction or co-direction. And I take my smooth function and extend it to be homogeneous of degree zero. So I want a pseudo-differential operator of order zero whose principal symbol, and I'll give an example in a second, is principal symbol is A of X. Now, that only defines the principal symbol, but for the fluctuations, for the limits, and the equidistribution questions that I'm interested in, doesn't matter what you make the lower order symbols. You just have to take my word for that. And so this doesn't seem well defined, and that is one of the main problems in quantizing, but for the questions I'm asking, it is well defined. So choose any operator with this property, and I'll call that op A, and this is the quantum observable. This is the thing you're going to compare and observe in the quantum system and compare with the classical. For example, and this is all you need to think about, even though the complete picture requires taking general functions here, if A of X and Xi is just a function of X alone. So a pseudo-differential operator, a differential operator, I hope you all know what that is. So you differentiate and you've got variable coefficients. A pseudo-differential operator in the Fourier transform will have some degree of homogeneity in Xi, which is not zero. It'll be order one or two or something. To force it to be order zero, I have to introduce a pseudo-differential operator because there's no differential operator of order zero that depends on Xi, except for this kind. So suppose A of X and Xi is just simply A of X, doesn't depend on Xi. That's certainly a good function here. Then op A of some function applied to Xi of X is just A of X, just a multiplication of times A of X times Xi of X. That's all it is, nothing more, nothing less. And otherwise, it's measuring how this vector moves on applying a zeroth order pseudo-differential operator also. That's how you quantize an observable, but you also have to quantize the motion. For that, you have to write down a Schrodinger equation, which comes from the Hamiltonian, and to cut a long story short, but not such a long story, but a standard story, you are studying the following, which is the main connection to this yesterday's lecture at the first level, is you're studying, so the quantization is the Schrodinger equation, which I won't write, and then if you study the solutions, you get to study the eigenstates of Laplacian. So Laplacian phi lambda plus phi equals zero, giving me eigenfunctions phi lambda like I defined yesterday. So these now are functions, phi are functions on x, which is h mod gamma in this situation. Laplacian is divergence gradient. So all this is general. And I'm looking at maybe the spectral theory on L2 of x. I'm assuming it's compact for simplicity. And then we get eigenfunctions, phi 1, phi 2, maybe phi naught, the constant function, phi 1, phi 2, and an orthonormal basis, and lambda naught, lambda 1, lambda 2, could be with multiplicity, eigenvalues. And the quantum mechanics is concerned with these eigenstates, which we might want to then make an observation of A in this quantum mechanics, which amounts to the following. So the analog of the classical observable A is to observe or to measure. This is what actually in quantum mechanics is measured. That's why it's called an observable. The key things is fix A, that's above, and we the quantum observable. Quantum observables in the state phi lambda or phi j, these are eigenfunctions of the Laplacian, is the inner product of op A applied to phi j, inner product phi j. This is as lambda j moves to infinity. Those will be the numbers that you are studying. So classically, you have this orbit and you just measure A along the orbit. Quantum mechanically, this is the quantum observable in the state phi j. These eigenfunctions are called states. For us, they will eventually be automorphic forms. And this limit as lambda j goes to infinity, well, in any equidistribution problem, something must, some parameter, you need more and more of something. And in this case, this is called the semi-classical limit. So this is all very well studied and much studied by physicists recently. And I gave In these Blythe lectures many years ago, I gave lectures on what was called arithmetic quantum chaos, which was the setup of all this machinery. I now want to describe the solution to one or two of the problems mentioned there. One of the main problems is, okay, so how are these are numbers, real numbers, and how are they distributed? Are they related at all, these quantum fluctuations, to the classical fluctuations of A? Now, these kind of questions are very well understood if the classical mechanics is what's called integrable, means it's got integrals of motion. But if the classical mechanics is chaotic and ergodic, like this example, and this is the probably most interesting example, then these questions of trying to understand the fine structure of quantization have always been problematic. Nobody could really say anything about this from the start of quantum mechanics. And nobody tried to because it was too hard. But what did change 10 or 20 years ago, and that's one of the 10 years ago is what certainly turned, what attracted me into this, is there is a tremendous amount of physics literature of phenomenology. There are programs now that can compute your eigenfunctions. I even gave you some pictures yesterday of the first four eigenfunctions of the modular group. Those will be the most interesting to us, not those first four, but this question there. And those eigenfunctions can be computed numerically, and then you have all this literature of people making claims and theorems, but they're all just phenomenology. It's very much like the theory of rational dynamics, which was invented by Fatou and Julia in 1917, about iterations of maps of the sphere, polynomial maps, and you iterate it. It changed dramatically about 1975 when people got personal computers and could write programs to write, just draw pictures of Mandelbrot sets and Julia sets and Fatou sets, and then there was a tremendous wealth of data, and trying to prove what you see there is, was always very difficult, and what has been achieved is not bad, but it's still very modest as to what you can do numerically. The subject here is a little worse off in that we can prove much less of what you see in experimentation. But one of the interesting things that was put forth by physicists, which I will convince you is false in a minute, but that shouldn't bother anybody. You'll see that what is true is quite interesting. So there was a conjecture, so let me put this in naive. So how are these distributed? This is one question. One way of asking this is, I should remind you how many eigenvalues there are. So recall, Weyl's law, a theorem in mathematical physics, but also a theorem in the subject of automorphic forms, because it counts how many such eigenfunctions there are. If you let n lambda, this is a very general theorem in a compact quotient, of the number of lambda j less than or equal to lambda of 1, counted with multiplicity. You count how many eigenvalues there are less than lambda for this eigenvalue problem on a compact manifold surface, dimension 2. Weyl proved in a paper that was quite a sensation at the time, 1905 or so, 1910, that this is asymptotic to the volume of x, in this case the area of x, over 4 pi times lambda. This is in dimension 2. Dimension x equals 2, let me just remark that. So the number of eigenvalues we know, it will be important in a moment. And now, so we got, say, if A is fixed, we got this many numbers. And we can ask, what's the mean? What's the variance? And maybe it becomes Gaussian. And that is the naive conjecture of physicists based on some very special calculations, numerical, in my opinion. But that is a very lovely conjecture, if you wish. And it's quite bold because it says the following. So here's the suggestion. I don't want to call it, of course, in the literature and in the paper. Oh, I have something on the web for the first time in my life, so let me boast. So the paper that I said that has a lot of what I'm stating here at least explained maybe a little more fully is on the web at www.princeton.edu. So you don't have to copy it or anything. Something like /Sarnak. And it's called file. There's only two files there. It's called Baltimore. They're both called, one is old and one is new. The new one is the one to look at. And it's on there you will see details of what I'm saying here, which I think are explained more clearly. And most importantly, you'll see all references to the physics papers that I'm talking about. So I'll call this physics suggestion, because I'll show you it's false, but most physicists will say, yeah, but this is the standard. One of the distinguished lecturers there at the back, I see him from here, his name's Michael Berry. So when I show him that, he says A implies B, and I show, look, here's A, it's false. He says, yeah, but of course it's false. If you work hard to show it's false, then it's obviously going to be false. You're not supposed to work hard to show it's false. So then I explain to him, look, is it ever true? Ah, that's an interesting question. He says, then you say to him, well, it's hard to prove a theorem if you don't know what the implication is. You have to have a statement which at least is true, never mind whether it's you have a proof. So this suggestion made by, not by him actually, but by others, is immediately false, as I'll explain, but it is so suggestive that it's desperate to be true, as you will see. And that is that the quantum fluctuations are also Gaussian. So that these numbers are Gaussian in the following way. So firstly, with a certain mean, the sum, this is a fact, this is very easy. In using the theory of Fourier integral operators, one can easily show that op A, phi j, some lambda j less. So this is a general easy fact. The mean value of these numbers is in fact A bar. So if you divide by n lambda, by the number, the mean value of these numbers, which is what you're trying to understand, will converge to A bar. The variance, now the variance are the fluctuations. There we had to divide by square root t in Ratner's theorem. You integrate it up to t, so it's a variance about the mean. So assume A bar is zero, then the conjecture, which as I say is based on some experimentation on numerics and some heuristics which are quite reasonable, of A phi j, phi j squared, 1 over n lambda, no, 1 over square root lambda. N lambda is about lambda, so it's square root of that. So this should be asymptotic, the variance, this is the variance. This should be asymptotic too. And the lovely statement that they put forth is the classical variance, so the quantum should be the same as the classical. If true, it couldn't be nicer, even though times square root lambda. And then that's the second moment, that's the first moment, and then the Gaussian is the statement that once you normalize by the second moment, you will get straight Gaussian. The numerics, let me say, even on the systems that they checked, which do not include this surface of negative curvature, but which is now being checked for these after what I'm going to tell you, so they have code to do. As I said, there is plenty numerical techniques and effort going into computing many eigenvalues and eigenfunctions so that these things can be computed for the first 4,000 or 5,000 eigenvalues and the eigenfunctions. So the numbers and the eigenfunctions, and you can check these kind of things. So this part is a little, if you look at the data in the papers I refer to in there, you'll see that this is not so accurate. It's probably 90%. This actual, let the variance be this. And remember, this is a function of A. It's a functional of A, which clearly is a very interesting quadratic form in A, which I determined in this case. What is much more convincing numerically is once you normalize by the variance, and this is how statistics often, this is a suggestion. I call it a suggestion because I'm going to show you it's false right now. But it's a very good suggestion. The part that's much more robust is once the variance, once you divide by the variance, you normalize by the variance, then the Gaussian fit is perfect. But Gaussian comes from any kind of randomness, so you must be careful how much you read into Gaussian, in my opinion. So the claim is that the quantum fluctuations are like the classical fluctuations for such a chaotic system. If you have a system which is not chaotic, neither the classical nor the quantum are at all in random in this sense, typically, say an integrable system. All right, let me just point out it's false. And it'll be false for the case. I'm eventually going to tell you what the answer is today for the modular group, what the quantum fluctuations are in the modular group. The classical fluctuations are, as Ratner describes. The quantum fluctuations are going to be, as you might guess, quite close to the conjecture, but significantly, interestingly different. And let's say, so suppose, just to sober yourself up, in case you were a little too excited by this conjecture. Suppose that the manifold X, this can be set up completely generally, all you need is a classical motion be chaotic, but suppose X, like our surface, has an even odd symmetry. I haven't brought this to Barry, but I'll tell you his reaction immediately whilst I explain this. So I've got an even to odd symmetry. So the modular group is a very good example. This is the fundamental domain for the modular group, and I hope everybody's seen that in a complex analysis book. That's the if you look at the linear fractional action of SL to Z on the upper half plane, every point can be brought into the set as I've drawn it, and basically up to the boundary. This is a unique set, and so to understand the quotient, this is not compact, but ignore that point. So I'll call it X1, which is H of SL to Z, that'll be the guy I'm going to study in a moment. Let's assume I have a symmetry. This guy has an even odd symmetry, which is an isometry of the hyperbolic metric. It's not an analytic map. So if you're doing complex analysis, that's not a symmetry. But if you're doing eigenfunctions, that's even and odd. The eigenfunctions break up into being either even or odd, or at least can be chosen that way. a base, orthonormal basis can be chosen. So if there's an even odd symmetry, then all eigenfunctions are real. Phi lambda squared of x is always even, no matter whether phi was even or odd. Phi squared is even. Quantum mechanics knows about symmetries. Classical mechanics doesn't. That's why this conjecture has to be false. So if you square this, it's always even. And then if you take a of x, just to be a multiplication operator, not any fancy pseudo-differential operator, to be odd about the symmetry, then op a applied to phi lambda in a product phi lambda is zero for all lambda, for all lambda j. So the quantum fluctuations are zero, and mean zero, of course. Well, odd is what means zero. So the quantum fluctuations all vanish. So quantum fluctuations are identically zero. But the classical fluctuations are not. But I didn't point this out, but V of A is not zero. If you go along a generic equidistributed orbit, it doesn't know about the symmetry. What it does know is here's my orbit, and there's another orbit which is reflecting me on the other side. But when I'm computing how I vary along this orbit, this generic orbit, I don't know about the other orbit. Quantum mechanics knows the symmetry. Classical mechanics doesn't. That's the problem. So it turns out that V of A, I didn't write this down. I computed what V of A was in this example, and I should say it's part of Ratner's work, that the only way that V of A can be zero, V of A is obviously non-negative. It was an integral of a positive definite function. Well, it was gotten by integrating something squared. It was a variance. It's non-negative. It can be zero. The only way V of A can be zero is if A is the derivative in the geodesic flow direction of another function. You can't have randomness. If you integrate from 0 to 0 to t, the derivative of a function, then by integration by parts, it's by the fundamental theorem of calculus, it's the value at the endpoint minus the value. That won't be Gaussian. That'll just be a bunch of numbers. It's not that when you divide by root t, it'll just go to 0. So as long as A is not the derivative in the Unitan tension bundle of another function, then V of A is not 0. That's part of the Ratner theorem. And a function which just lives on the manifold and is odd is easily seen to be not the derivative if lifted to the cotangent space. It's not the flow derivative of another function. You can easily check that. So this conjecture is simply, this suggestion is nonsense if there's a symmetry. But then, of course, any physicist will say to you, yeah, but of course there's a symmetry. Why do you do that? Just assume there are no symmetries. It won't fix it up, but it now is going to be so subtle because there could be notions that are much more subtle and not direct symmetries but are going to affect the truth of this. And that you will see now dramatically in this example. Let me leave up this variance and now I want to state the theorem. Before I state the theorem, let me tell you one general theorem just so we measure what partial differential equations can do. So you might say, why not tackle these problems using Fourier integral operators? And of course, one does try. But this is trying, this kind of problem that we're trying to understand is one of harmonic analysis, one where you're trying to beat the uncertainty principle. You're trying to understand something. Here it's an average, but it's an average which, as I will say later, is beyond the diagonal. Turns out that the theory of L functions, and specifically the Riemann hypothesis, if we could use it, which could be very useful here, allows you to look at one thing at a time. It's the tool which allows you to... So it's interesting that these difficult questions that are raised by physicists are very hard to tackle in general, and I'll give you the only general theorem, but when we restrict to an arithmetic manifold, and I mentioned yesterday that the spectral problem of automorphic forms is really a spectral problem, and so it's one of a chaotic system in its simplest case, when we restrict to that kind of situation, then we do have tools which are not proven. Those conjectures I wrote down are exactly the tools to solve these interesting problems. And the progress we can make is to solve some of these without appealing to those Riemann, Ramanujan, or Lindelof. And they will be used, one thing will be used in this proof of the theorem I'm about to state. But here's a general theorem. the only general theorem in the subject. It's a stunning theorem, actually. It was formulated by Schnirelmann in 74, and it was proved by him, I believe, but never written down. It was the theorem of Schnirelmann. This Schnirelmann is the nephew of the more well-known Schnirelmann, but he's also well-known, in my opinion. He's he was in Israel. He left recently. Schnirelmann, Colin de Verdier, these are all Fourier integral operator people, and Zeldich. This is not a joint piece of work. It's three different works, but they all have their important input to obtain the theorem I'm about to write down. This is a general theorem. It uses only that GT is ergodic, not the chaotic aspect, and I call it the quantum ergodicity theorem. This is quantum ergodicity. It's the analog in the quantum setting of ergodicity, and it says the following: the sum of lambda j less than or equal to lambda of it computes that variance, it estimates that variance op a phi lambda j, I'm just calling it phi j, phi j a bar 0 squared. So these sums, which are trivially big O, meaning less than a constant times lambda, because each of these are L2 norm 1, and A is, of course, this is a bounded operator, uniformly bounded. So this is big O of lambda. The remarkable thing is it's little O of lambda. That's their theorem. It's a very deep theorem. It's the only general theorem, and it uses what's called Egorov's theorem in propagation of singularities as its main ingredient. And the reason I call this quantum ergodicity is these are positive numbers. If you sum positive numbers and get a little o of the number you're summing up, then almost all of them must go to zero. So this proves that almost all of those observables go to zero, which on a diagonalization process leads quickly to almost all, in the sense of density of the eigenvalues, of these eigenmeasures, of these quantum measures, mu j equal to op mu a applied to a is a measure on the cotangent space, which is op a phi j phi j. It's a quadratic thing in j, in phi j, but it's a measure on the cotangent space. The integral of a bars mean zero. Almost all of these measures, you don't have to assume that in this part, become equidistributed. So just like almost all orbits classically become equidistributed, almost all of these eigenstate measures, which tell you in state phi j what the distribution of your particle is in that state, become equidistributed, which is certainly beautiful, and it's a consequence of ergodicity, and it's what we might call quantum ergodicity. So the only thing we know how to do in general from Fourier integral operators is to estimate the variance by little o, and notice what these guys are conjecturing is square root. That's much harder to even get down to the square root, never mind what the functional dependence of the term in front is. Okay, so now let me state the theorem, which is the answer for the quantum fluctuations for the modular group. So now specialize to an arithmetic situation, in fact, a very special arithmetic situation. X1, the modular surface. I'll call it the modular surface. So the phi lambdas now are, as I was calling them, automorphic forms yesterday. They are eigenforms of the Laplacian. I'll assume they're also Hecker eigenforms, so they correspond to pi lambda, automorphic, cuspidal, just to connect with yesterday's definition, representations of GL2 AQ, trivial central character, and everywhere unramified. This is full level. Everywhere unramified and also at infinity unramified. So that's a fancy way of just talking about the spectrum on the upper half plane for the full modular group. And those first, for the first four eigenfunctions, I showed you a picture of those yesterday. And we know pictures of them for very, very large lambda. And those eigenfunctions become highly oscillatory in a very complex way from the numerics. And we are asking, how do the op a phi k, this thing, distribute? So what's the variance? And here's the answer. So remember the conjecture. Remember, it cannot be correct. because there is a symmetry here, so at least for half of them, the quantum fluctuations are going to be identically zero. There's no central limit theorem. But for the other half, we don't know. And maybe that conjecture is right. Well, this is what the answer is. 10 years ago, I could not do this. There's a lot of developments since. This is a theorem. Uses a lot of machinery. This is the theorem of Luo and myself that's still being written up. Okay, so for X1 and for cusp forms, everything will be, most of the spectrum is cuspidal. I should have said that. N lambda, just an aside here, this N lambda for X1, the number of cusp eigenvalues, whatever that is, or discrete eigenvalues, is asymptotic, in fact, to the area of X1, which is pi over 12. Divided by 4 pi, which is pi over 3, sorry, times lambda. That's not a trivial fact. The proof of that fact, that the modular quotient has many cusp forms, was the very reason Selberg invented the Selberg trace formula. The very reason. He wanted to prove there were cusp forms. He went to Göttingen in 1952, listened to Maas and Siegel thinking about, they had just invented this new kind of object, which freed them of holomorphic structure, and they had these new kind of Maas forms that Maas, of course, introduced. That's why we call them that. Maas was a student of Siegel, and they asked Selberg, I'm just repeating what he told me, they asked him if he could produce examples in the holomorphic setting. One understood that most of the space is cuspidal. Eisenstein series give very few objects, which are, there's a theory of Eisenstein series here too. I don't want to get technical. And Selberg sat quietly and thought, one way to show that is to compute a trace that might show me they exist. And it's the only way we know they exist. And he developed a whole non-compact trace formula for this application and then got quite excited by his formula that it was actually useful beyond this, as we all know today. And I'm sure many of you here know, since I think the ball of the trace formula has been picked up by Arthur. He's carried it forth. I understand you'll be here tomorrow. I won't mention it. For X1, so for this modular surface, one, there are three parts of the theorem. The order of magnitude is indeed that, so the sum of lambda j less than or equal to lambda of cusp forms of op A. Okay, I'll assume now, sorry, X1, and I'll assume A equals C of X only. I'm sure the theorem will be true for the most general function on the unit cotangent space, but it's only been checked so far for functions which depend only on the variable x, not on c. Op A phi j squared is indeed asymptotic, as it should be, to square root lambda, but the quadratic form, there's some deep quadratic form here, is not that. I'll tell you what it is in a moment. Not V of A, we'll call it B of A, some very subtle quadratic form, so that the order of magnitude out is correct. By far, the most interesting thing we found, which took the longest time, was that B, polarized B, now this looks trivial. Let me just make excuses for what I took. Once I tell you all that, we had proved this and I had not been looking for this self-adjointness, which I only looked for here in this classical variance much later. So this is some other quadratic form on the same space of functions on G mod gamma with mean zero, A bar zero. If you'd seen that, you might have hoped to understand this, and indeed this is a remarkable fact, that if you polarize B, whatever it is, I'll show you the expression we have for B, and then you'll maybe be quite shocked that this is true. It's self-adjoint also with respect to Laplacian. So whatever this quadratic form is a rather deep quadratic form. And then, since this is diagonalized, so in fact, B is diagonalized, quite surprisingly, this leading term in the quantum fluctuation is diagonalized by the eigenfunctions themselves. Eigenfunctions, automorphic forms, phi lambda themselves, just like V was. So not only is their answer the right order and their quadratic form diagonalized by the same set of eigenfunctions, everything is pointing now that maybe that conjecture is true. So both these quadratic forms, V, which was the classical variance, and B, which is the quantum variance, are diagonalized by the identical objects, but they are not the same. They have slightly different eigenvalues. So 3, B of phi, lambda, so I only have to now check what B is on an eigenfunction, is equal to V of phi lambda times a correction factor. So what they conjecture is right, but there's a factor that comes in here, L1 half phi lambda. The value at a half of the standard L function, I introduced L functions yesterday. The fact that L functions come out in the answer is probably a hint that this was proved using L functions. So there is this remarkable number, the most interesting value of any L function. So remember, I introduced automorphic forms yesterday precisely to emphasize the fact that these are given a pi, and phi lambda is one, the most basic of all pi's, given automorphic cuspidal representation pi, there's an L function, a finite L function, this is the finite L function associated with it. It has a functional equation s into 1 minus s, these are self-dual, and this is the central value, it's potentially zero. The Riemann hypothesis says you can't vanish off the line, real part of s equals half, but you can certainly vanish at a half. In fact, it's very interesting when you do. So this number could be zero. In fact, if phi is odd, then this is automatically zero because the sign of the functional equation is odd, and that fixes up all that first contradiction. Anytime phi was odd, we knew that's going to have to be zero. This L function knows about it, fixes it up. And if the thing's even, this is, could possibly vanish. If you generalize it, it will vanish. So there's some deep vanishing, perhaps. But in any event, this arithmetic factor just fixes up the whole story. Their conjecture is true as long as you put this deep arithmetic factor. It's deep because it requires analytic continuation and evaluation at a point which is outside the region of convergence and a point at which you can potentially vanish even. So this arithmetic factor compares completely the classic, the quantum fluctuation, the quantum variance. The quantum variance is trying its best to be equal to the classical variance, as was expected maybe by these fellows, but it's not true. This arithmetic factor, special value of an L function R, fixes everything up, corrects everything. This is the only case we know the answer. I can't do it even in a division algebra. The techniques are pushing all the they push to the limit of what we know. Let me point out here something quite remarkable. The operator, this quadratic form, of course, gives rise to an operator. So note, B, any quadratic form by linear algebra or functional analysis gives rise to a linear operator A. First defined on a dense domain, but eventually extended to L2 naught. Well, in this case, I've just been working on H mod gamma, such that A, C, C is, or A C1 C2 is B C1 C2. That's the definition of the linear operator A. This is the ordinary in a product. This is this quadratic form in a product that comes out of the theorem. Because B is positive, we have that A is a non-negative operator, and the eigenvalues, and it can be diagonalized, and the eigenvalues of A are up to fudge factors, which I'd always viewed this as a fudge factor, only the fudge factor, the extra factor there, is V. The only proof I have of that is by the way the theorem is proved is you get that it's L1 half times this weird ratio of gamma functions, which I'd never just viewed as some strange appendage to the formula, but I now know what it is. It's the classical variance. Let me just emphasize. The way the theorem is proved is you obtain the answer, you then use some material I'll describe tomorrow, which uses Euler products of degree 8, uses quite sophisticated methods to actually compute this, but when you compute this, you get this as the, for B, you get this times that quantity, which I separately have computed as the classical variance. So that so that it didn't come naturally out, or it didn't come from our work naturally out. It's just a fact in the end. And so A is non-negative. Its eigenvalues up to that simple proportionality factor, or fudge factor, the eigenvalues of A are L 1/2 phi. And hence, if you have eigenvalues of a non-negative operator, L 1/2 phi is non-negative. So you have an operator on a Hilbert space, a non-negative operator on a Hilbert space, whose it's non-negative, that's the D part. In one basis, it's positive. In another basis, it pulls out these special values of L functions. You know, everybody has a dream to make an operator on a Hilbert space whose eigenvalues are the zeros of a zeta function. What we have here is a family of L functions and an operator on a Hilbert space whose eigenvalues are special values of the L functions in a family, and the operator is quite deep. It would be very hard to invent this operator, because in the one basis, I mean, it proves this thing which is non-negative. The non-negativity of the special value of an automorphic form like that is a highly non-trivial fact. This isn't the only proof of this. There are now many proofs of this. 2 weeks ago, I outlined all the proofs I know of it in Rollis's conference. But this is perhaps one of the most interesting proofs, in that it comes out of an operator on a Hilbert space whose eigenvalues are these numbers. That is very hard to invent. If I asked you to prove this is non-negative, would you start to think of doing those asymptotics? Well, I wouldn't. This just came out and was realized only at the end. It fell into your lap. I mean, it is true, and the Selberg lambda sieve is a good example of where this happens. If you have some asymptotics, like in Selberg's work, it was the mean square of zeta times what we call a mollifier, has a certain asymptotics, which is a quadratic form in the variables, and then if you get some asymptotics of this type and it's not it's not trivial, the quadratic form, it's very often that you can diagonalize that quadratic form and it's got a lot of depth. In his case, that led to the lambda squared sieve. In here, this case, this quadratic form is got these as eigenvalues. Rather remarkable. So let me end because tomorrow I'm going to show a bit of that formula and other applications, all of which are then sort of more mainstream L functions, and a number of other theorems that get proved using L functions. But the first part of this theorem, this part, well, both the existence and the self-adjointness, which is really crucial in order to get to eventually have the luxury of computing B on eigenspaces, is proved we only have one way to do it, and I just want to show you how B came into our hands. So I'm going to write down a long formula and stop of what B is on a certain dense set of vectors, which is how we compute it, and from which a lot of staring will show you this property. And this should be a functorial general property. I believe it's something quite general. After all, V had this property, B has the property. It shouldn't come out of the final formula, but that's the only way we know how to do it. And so let me just end with this part, because such a quadratic form with such beautiful properties of eventually proving this can only come from off-diagonal. Experts know what I mean. All this is going to only come from off-diagonal and an infinite sum of arithmetic geometric series. So I'm going to write the answer here. So, and this is just technical for a moment, let H be a smooth function of compact support on the positive reals, and let PH of Z, this is all on SL2Z, be the following function, sum over gamma mod gamma infinity. That's like an Eisenstein series, gamma infinity is the subgroup 1M01M in Z, of H of Y of gamma Z. This, I think, goes by the misnaming Poincaré series. It's some generalization of Eisenstein series. So this is an averaging, so this function's already invariant under gamma infinity. This is e to the 2 pi I, the real part of gamma z. This is h of the imaginary part of gamma z. That series converges trivially. H is compact support. And this function gives me an automorphic function. This is a function in c naught infinity of x1. And what we do in this proof is we first test this, try compute what this is for A of this type. And so after polarizing, so you prove after a lot of machinery that has been developed by averaging other families, Kuznetsov trace formula, I won't go into this at all, But just let me tell you the nature of the answer. It turns out that B of pH1, pH2, and these essentially span these pHs, so it's a dense enough set to get the these relations, turns out to be the following. It's a quadratic form in H1 and H2, of course, because what else could it be? It's a quadratic function in P. The only objects you don't know are H1 and H2. Okay. It's pi over 4. I'll just write this down and say a word and stop. This is what you would get from the diagonal, which would be boring, but which, of course, would be a perfectly acceptable answer, just the ordinary inner product of H1 and H2 with respect to dx of x squared. However, it's the off-diagonal which, and there has to be serious off-diagonal if L functions at a half are going to come in, is an infinite sum of, as I said, arithmetic geometric sum. So 2 over root 2, the sum c equals 1 to infinity, of beta c over c to the 5 halves, the double integral, 0 to infinity. So it's a quadratic form in H1 and H2 with a very weird kernel. Maybe somebody can explain this better than we do. I hope so. I'll continue here. I hope you can bear with me a second here. H2 of y dx over x squared, same measure, dy over y squared. So that's a quadratic form in H1 and H2. Infinite sum, I should tell you what beta of c is. Beta of c is a three-dimensional exponential sum. I will find out field if c is prime. Beta of c is e to the 1 over 2c, e to the 2 pi I over 2c, the sum A modulo C, the sum B modulo C. So all this stuff is off diagonal. This is a Clostermann sum, so I'll define it. But it's another, and twisted by e to the 2ab plus a plus b over c. So all this is a sum modulo C. It's a triple sum because S, M, N, C is the sum of x, x bar, congruent to 1 mod c of e to the 2 pi I mx plus nx bar over c. This is the finite field Bessel function. So beta of c is some very complicated function of c. And this quadratic form is that. Now you can see why it was difficult to diagonalize that quadratic form. We diagonalized it. Its eigenvalues are L at a half. And the most important thing to note is not diagonalizing it from this point of view, but I'll give you one remark, because once this was observed, everything flows quite nicely. It's a simple observation, but this and an analog for Hecker operators is needed. Look at that kernel there. Let me call this weird kernel here, this function of x and y here. Let me call it kxy. It's symmetric in x and y, and if you apply Lx, which is x squared, so L equal x squared d2 by dx squared minus 4 pi squared x squared. That's a variable coefficient differential operator in x. The key observation is L sub x applied to k is the same as L sub y applied to k. If you take this, you differentiate it with respect to x twice, multiply by x squared, add this times x squared, you'll get the same expression as if you do it with y. That symmetry eventually transforms itself to part B of the theorem, which unfortunately I erased, which allows us to show that this expression, which in this point is some quite messy thing, has a property that Laplacian on this variable can be brought over to here, which means that the eigenfunctions diagonalize this amazing quadratic form. Tomorrow I'll explain, amongst many other things, how you compute that directly on eigenfunctions, which then pull out a very simple answer. The moral of the story is, in this form, in this basis where everything's positive, this is the nature of the answer, and it's very hard to diagonalize it. But in another form, which uses L functions, on the eigenbasis, only the diagonal contribution will contribute, and so that's why you can get an answer. So what I've explained here, I hope in some vague terms, is the comparison of the quantum fluctuation to the classical fluctuation, which is now known in only one example, SL2Z. And if I say so, our tools anyway are completely based on the theory of L functions and automorphic forms. And they have to be, because the answer is that subtle. The conjecture made by these fellows is no doubt true if the manifold is shaken a little bit and is not arithmetic or generic. It wants to be what it is. It has to be fixed up, and if there's no L function around, it's probably correct. Anyway, these things are now being rechecked because this quadratic form is obviously a very fundamental one associated with a quantum fluctuation. Well, I went over time, so I stopped. Sorry. Thank you.